The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, everyone, we're going to start up with our second panel this morning. As I mentioned earlier, we have panels 2 and 3 on either side of lunch, divided up according to the privacy side of the balance and the public interest side of the balance. And this panel will talk about not only categorical balancing, but also that practical obscurity concept and what it has led to in the past 20 years. And to moderate this panel, we have the current executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, who since 2000 has been Jane's successor and is the person who, more than anyone else, deals with members of the press, members of the media in all incarnations, who will call and say, you can't believe what that agency is doing to me under the FOIA. Lucy Dogleish not only is an attorney, but also, like Jane, she comes from a journalist background. She was both a reporter and an attorney. She's also on the board of directors of the National Freedom of Information Coalition and has probably more experience now in this area than anyone else currently working on that in that realm and the public interest side. So I'm going to turn it over to Lucy to then introduce the other panel members and see what we can come up with respect to the application and ramifications and permutations of the Reporters Committee decision on the privacy side of the balance. Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Dan. Well, just as I think Jane described that she sort of came in with the aftermath of the Reporters Committee case, I've sort of had the aftermath the last decade of the Reporters Committee case. And I just want to say right off the bat, privacy is important to the Reporters Committee. Privacy is important to society. Privacy is important to individual people. The Reporters Committee is not anti-privacy. We have articulated numerous times in the 9 years I've been at the Reporters Committee that there is a need for individuals to protect medical records. There is a need for individuals to protect their financial information. There is a need to protect general access to numerical identifiers to prevent identity theft. The Reporters Committee has never been anti-privacy. But then we come up with this doctrine of practical obscurity. You know, I tell people in general when I'm trying to describe what it is, you know, how the difference is between the way the states operate and handle their records and the way the feds do, and I have two general rules of thumb. Number one, particularly with advances in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and South Dakota recently, there is not a single state out there that does not have a better public access law than the federal government. And my other rule of thumb is, and I know Dave Schultz has heard me say this, if the federal government, if the executive branch of the federal government has a document that mentions a live human being, just give up. And that's a general rule of thumb, but it plays out fairly accurately, I think. When you're talking about the doctrine of practical obscurity, you are talking about information, the underlying documents, the underlying information, the underlying data is public. And when you're a reporter and all of a sudden you see the information age and you think, my God, with all of this digitization and all of this access, I can do a better job. I don't have to waste my time going from courthouse to courthouse to courthouse to courthouse, or police station to police station, or city hall to city hall, or anything. I can do my job in a better way. Look what technology allows me to do. Whereas people on the more pro-privacy side look at it when they're thinking about these public records, and they're going, oh, my God, look what this technology allows them to do. Isn't that horrible? And these are two entirely different mindsets. We advocate, as Jane mentioned, she's in Minnesota now, and I remember we were both at a hearing where they were talking about access to court records. Where we see this issue pop up really nationwide lately has not been in any state or federal executive branch agencies. It's been with these courts that are trying to compile electronic access to court information. And they are taking this FOIA statutory framework in the court system, and they are importing this executive branch administrative rule, statutory rule, to documents that there is, generally speaking, a constitutional right of access to. And it makes it incredibly frustrating. A couple of other points, one other specifically that I'd like to make before I introduce our panelists, is that it's not like this information is inaccessible. It's not like I can't go out and get somebody's rap sheet in a lot of jurisdictions right now. That stuff actually is available, and you know why it's unavailable? It's, I have a high school classmate, her name is Lisa, and she and her husband about 15 years ago started a company. They decided that since there was nobody out there making this criminal data and other public records data available government-wide, they were going to start a company and start compiling it and selling it. I don't know about any of the rest of you, but I certainly have gone online, paid my $34.95, and basically gotten this information. So the notion that this stuff is not available and that we're not protecting all the people's privacy having to do with their criminal records is absolutely nonsense. So now you kind of have an idea where I'm coming from with this type of information. And I'd like to introduce our panelists. First of all, we have Jim Harper, is the Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He focuses on the problems of adapting law and policy to the unique problems of the digital age. He's a member of the Department of Homeland Security's Data Privacy and Integrity Advisory Committee. He's an author. He's recently written the book Identity Crisis, How Identification is Overused and Misunderstood. And he also, if you get a chance, go to his web-based think tank called Privacilla. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's the editor of privacilla.org. Sitting next to Jim is Tonda Rush, a longtime friend of mine. Actually, I think you got one of your early jobs was working as the director of the FOIA Service Center at the Reporters Committee at the extreme, very early days of this particular case. Tonda is the president of the American Press Works in Arlington, Virginia, and she's the former CEO of the National Newspaper Association. She represents the National Newspaper Association's Washington office. She's been a law professor. She, as I mentioned, worked for the Reporters Committee. She and I are both members of the Sunshine and Government Initiative Steering Committee. Tonda is one of the nation's leading experts on how public information laws work. And finally, Ari Schwartz is the Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Center for Democracy and Technology. His work focuses on increasing individual control over personal and public information. And again, I run into Ari frequently, and he is an expert in anything, all things digital. I'd like to start out with Tonda, because we just heard from all of the folks sort of talking about why the Reporters Committee decision was so wonderful. So I'd like to start off with Tonda and ask her a multi-part question. First of all, I'm curious as to what your initial reaction was when the Reporters Committee decision came down. Has it played out the way you expected it then? And perhaps most importantly, what are journalists and citizens not finding out as a result of this decision, and is that a problem?
Well, I've had to laugh at the reminiscences of Jane and Lucy about the halcyon days of the early Reporters Committee, something that I see some faces in the audience that might claim to be old enough to remember how the Reporters Committee began and what it was really like. It often functioned in a billowing cloud of tobacco smoke because Jack was a chain smoker. He was also uniquely capable of coming up with interesting legal theories. He thought deeply about things, and things he could convince himself that he was right about something, and no one else could follow the logic of it. And maybe this case is a good example of that. Jack, we lost Jack in this last year. I was fond of him. I cheerfully wanted to strangle him at least once a day when I worked for him. But I have to say that he set up a voice in public policy that is unequaled. And Jane and Lucy have admirably carried that forward. When I saw this case coming, my reaction to it was about the same as my reaction when Jack decided to take on the SNAP against CIA case. And some of the others, where you just knew that we were going to be having we were having the fuzzy side of the lollipop. We were going to be opposing public opinion. We were going to be opposing the prevailing sentiments of the court. So we were going to be trying to articulate a legal theory that Jack, through his ability to twist the arms of very talented attorneys to go pro bono and argue these cases, would try to advance to the courts. I think that in the course of the litigation, the public sentiment about privacy saw a significant shift, and clearly the court shifted. And I think maybe those two elements can account for the way this case came out. I've often had debates about openness and privacy with privacy advocates, and I think one of the trickiest parts about this discussion is there really isn't an advocate in this context for openness. There really isn't. The openness advocate I analogize to the entities who are trying to argue that we should not tear down the Amazon rainforest because that one medicinal plant that might be found later to cure all human disease might be there. And in arguing for openness, many of us are finding ourselves arguing for an intangible, an inchoate value, the general concept of an open society that can tell the human tale to each other and can put the actions of government in context. And in the context of a privacy concern, it's to put it in the context of a human story, usually. But the public policy balancing test wants us not to articulate an intangible, an inchoate value. It doesn't want us to just argue that we've got a right to know things. It wants us to prove that there's actually something there we need to know and a reason we need to know it, just in the way we don't tear down the rainforest because we know that plant is out there. And so you're often in a position of not only proving a negative, but disproving motive. And in the case of the press, which often shows up here as the representative of the public, what you wind up with is a debate where the press organizations deeply feel they're representing the public. They believe they're representing the right to know. And the public policy shapers, whether they're the courts or the legislature, don't necessarily see the press as the advocate of the public. Often in privacy cases, you find the public interest groups that would normally be representing a public interest, if you will, on the other side, as we did in the Reporters case, where the ACLU decided to adopt the view of the pro-privacy interests. And so in the end, there's really no one there representing that little plant we haven't found in the forest yet. And we in the press are constantly arguing that it may be there, and even if it isn't there, we should keep the forest there because it should just be there. And that is, I think, the nature of the frustration and the difficulty in this debate. Everybody is pro-environmentalist and everybody is pro-privacy. But trying to prove why you should maintain openness is a lot like trying to prove why you shouldn't tear down the rainforest. And we've got a lot of other, we've got a lot of balancing act elements that are much more tangible, much more visible, and in some cases a lot scarier. So here we are at this place and time now where we have to argue for openness for information where a great body of society is worried about technology, is worried about the aggregation of records. But as comforting itself, I think, in the context of the Reporters Committee case, we haven't really made anything secret because these original open records are still in a dusty box in a basement in Iowa somewhere. And so we have a balance. The balance is the records are still open. We haven't really made them all secret. All we've done is protect people from the threats that computerization has created. So here we are. And I would say that I agree with Lucy, in the public policy arena, the privacy forces, I think, have all the trump cards at this point. I know technology looks like it's outstripping them, and it worries privacy protection organizations. But the voice for openness, just for the sake of openness, with the Reporters Committee case, with the Washington Post versus State Department case, and another line of cases that follow that, openness for the sake of openness has gradually faded from the scene. And I think we're now dealing with a legal regime where we have to articulate not a right to know, but a need to know. To me, that is the scariest part, because I think the need to know shift is almost one, it's a point of no return, almost. I'm not sure how you come back from the edge of that.
Well, let me follow up, Tonda, and ask you a question that comes up, what I hear from people, particularly as more public agencies, whether they be city halls or the federal government or whatever, this notion of practical obscurity these days, these records are no longer going to be put in dusty old bankers' boxes in the basement in Iowa. And I have heard people at various conferences say, you know, now we're not going to store these records in paper form anymore. They're not going to exist in paper form anymore. And so since they're not going to be kept in a file cabinet and we're not going to ask individual requesters, it's all going to become digital. And now, because it's so accessible, let's just close this information that's always been public. Let's just close it. Practical obscurity be damned kind of a situation. So the only way we can protect against all of that access is to just make information that has always been public no longer public.
Well, I think that's the insidious point that Jane was raising, that we've embarked on a legal theory now that by taking a record that was on paper and digitizing it and moving it into a searchable database has justified a different treatment of the record. It's stored differently, so therefore somehow the records become a different thing. The practical obscurity question, to me, is almost beyond the point of being a conundrum. Yes, I suppose there are print records, and you can get to them if you want to go to all the dirty basements in Iowa. As Lucy points out, a lot of them are now being computerized. The practical part of practical obscurity is that those base records, the arrest records, the police logs, things that when I was a reporter, you used to walk in and ask the sheriff to show you the piece of paper and you read it, are becoming increasingly difficult to access for reporters on a day-to-day basis because they are computerized. And more than that, there are now public information officers that become the gatekeepers to get to those things. You can't just walk in and see the log easily any longer. Some of you that have followed the wonderful national creation that's called Sunshine Week that happens in March every year have probably seen some of the studies that have been done on a statewide basis where citizens and reporters walk into sheriff's offices and ask to see records that under state law would be public, and discover that the sheriff has absolutely no intention of making that record. available and want to know why you need to know it. And if the sheriff doesn't agree with your reason to need to know, you may not get it unless you've got the resources to go to court. You layer on top of that the difficulties that we see in state and local governments, that the act of computerizing records requires programming and staff resources that they often don't have. And state and local agencies are hiring vendors to computerize records and create these databases, and then wanting to charge a gate fee for access to them, because now there's a company that has a sunk cost in developing that database. So obscurity is becoming, I would say, increasingly obscure. It's not just the Reporters Committee case that's gotten us to that point. I think the whole advent of digitization of records has put layers of complexity onto access that the law is fairly incapable of dealing with, and it's making us go back each time and justify a need to know instead of a right to know. We've got to go back each time and say, this record should remain open. Well, why should it? Why do you need to know it? And when the advocate for the openness is the press, you're dealing with the presumption that the only reason you really need to know is because you're very, very nosy. And besides that, you're trying to make more money by selling more newspapers. And so,
well, we know how well that's been working.
That's right. So there you go. You don't really still have that public voice out there arguing for openness. That public is invisible, I think, to the policymakers to a large degree.
Ari, what are your thoughts? Do you agree with Tonda?
On some points, I do agree with Tonda. In general, though, I think that there is that Tonda's sort of setting up a kind of win-lose situation. I'm concerned about in terms of the long-term impact of this policy. If you agree that privacy is a major issue and that openness is a major issue, then and they're both important values, then the question is, what is the policy that's going to move us forward where we can both protect privacy and keep records open? And that turns out not to be a very easy thing to do. There are certain things that you can do to keep information as it's become centralized, as it becomes computerized, and digital, how you protect that information down the road. And I'll just go through some ideas that we've raised in other in different areas where we've wanted to see public databases made public with information. Number one is to limit specific fields in the database. Try and figure out exactly what is of concern. You can look at the federal courts had bankruptcy records that had people's bank account numbers in them. There is little public interest in releasing the actual bank account numbers of individuals. Some people have disagreed with that. Most people seem to agree that having in a bankruptcy case or in this come up in divorce cases too, having the actual bank account numbers of individuals released leads to much public good. So can we go through and figure out what kinds of data we don't want in public records so therefore we can protect individuals that way? You can limit uses, and this is where you end up with this kind of need-to-know theory where you come up with only where you have certain exemptions. We have certain exemptions. You don't make public information available. You only make it available to potential employers or to people for insurance. There are some laws that do give journalists access to that information. But that's another tool that people use. And the third tool is practical obscurity, right, that you have the information, it's available, but it's just hard to get to. We've seen, one of the points that came up was, well, the private sector is taking this information in and is selling it. We know that they sell rap sheets. We know that they collect information. ChoicePoint and Axiom are probably the two best examples of this, right, companies that gather, literally go to the courts, court to court, gather information, centralize it, make it available to people. Well, they have this problem as well. They limit the use of the information to only those that they to those that have a need to know in certain situations, and it's come back to bite them when they haven't done a good job of it. ChoicePoint, for example, sold records to Nigerian identity thieves. Probably about in terms of those that are trying to do something malicious, number one on the list of people you shouldn't sell information to, they sold it to. So the system of how you go about solving some of these problems is difficult, I think, we have the question really is, how do you go about making more information available at a time when we should be making lots of information available? I wanted to point out, I mean, people have been pointing out that different dates here, but 1989 was also the birth of the web, right? It's exactly the same date, ironically, for the birth of the web. It didn't go public for another 4 years until after that, go commercial until 4 years after that. So, but the basic idea here is that right at the advent of the boom of the network, we have this law that is trying to rein things back in, which is not a perfect standard to do that. So the question is, well, then how do you de-identify data to make it available? How do you limit the ability for individuals to have it? How can we come up with a standard that can protect privacy and give individuals give society the responsibility of being able to have that information in a way where others are not harmed from the use of that? Those are difficult balancing tests. The fear that I have is you end up with one extreme or the other, right? You either end up with all the information being made available. We run into these problems with people doing things with personal information that we all agree people shouldn't do, identity theft being the most extreme example, stalking another extreme example, right? It's easy to come up with the extreme privacy examples, and I agree with Tonda. It's much easier to come up with the extreme privacy examples than it is to come up with the extreme closed government examples. But so we have those on one side. But then the other side is, for the complete openness, is the complete closure of the information. So if you don't have these kind of middle steps of practical obscurity, of being able to limit information, of being able to limit the uses, then you end up with the information completely closed. So we need to do a better job of figuring out what those middle steps are if practical obscurity is not the way to go. And I don't think that it's the way to go moving forward. I think that it doesn't work. It doesn't scale into the future. But it did address the idea of that we needed some kind of middle step. And so the question is, well, what's the middle step today? We've thrown out some of these ideas, but we need a lot more thinking on de-identification. And I urge the open government people to start thinking in these terms as well, because if you don't have these middle steps, we're going to end up at the extreme.
Thanks, Ari. Jim, your remarks, can you also address Ari's last point about is there a doctrine of practical obscurity in the future, or can we find middle ground here?
Oh, I think there's definitely a future for practical obscurity. It's essential to preserve practical obscurity. Let me say first, thanks for having me here. Thanks for all of you being here and participating with me on this panel. I'll say this, that I've never felt so bad being a privacy advocate because most of my advocacy is running up against interests that I don't think are very important. And here's one where the interest on the other side is an important interest. The DHS loves to collect lots of information for programs that don't really do much to secure the country, unfortunately, though I have friends here who may disagree. Let me step back a little bit and talk about what privacy is, because a lot of people mush a lot of different issues together when they use the word privacy. Privacy often refers to control of personal information. When information is already out there, it refers to fairness in how the information is used. People use the word privacy to talk about seclusion, that is not getting the telephone calls during the dinner hour and things like that. Personal security, which Ari mentioned in terms of both identity fraud and things like murder. And they also use the word privacy to describe really liberty. So what we're talking about in this case is really mostly about control. That is, how much information about people is out there. There are some fairness elements to it too. But I think it's important to understand the role of practical obscurity in protecting privacy. Because all of us, if you think about it, what we do all day, every day is available to others. What we eat for lunch, what time we leave for work, what we do, where we go in our cars, et cetera, et cetera. One of the issues I work on from time to time when a reporter calls me is red light cameras, digital systems that are supposed to help automate law enforcement. Well, digital cameras are just a step away from being a tracking system for cars throughout a city. And they could record the fact that a specific license plate goes from a workplace to the building where a psychiatrist's office is every Monday at 2 o'clock. And obviously you can tie a license plate to an individual pretty easily along with the workplace information. And this kind of system, built for law enforcement purposes, wonderful, right, is also a tracking system that could reveal the fact that a person is getting psychiatric treatment, something that's very personal that they might rather not have people know about. So this kind of system, which we generally want, probably, can rip practical obscurity away from someone's weekly visit to the psychiatrist. And so this is the kind of problem that we have with data systems. So maintaining practical obscurity, that's not using data so efficiently all the time, is an important privacy protection. You know, Scott McNeely, the chairman or CEO of Sun Microsystems, famously said, "You have no privacy, get over it." And he wasn't really talking about the true state of affairs. And he was talking about what could be if all data was put into uniform formats and shared everywhere. Well, that's absolutely what we don't want. I think he was wrong. We do have privacy because we have practical obscurity, even in data that has been, or even in information that has been reduced to data that has been put in digital form. So the middle ground where I come out on, which is completely unhelpful, is that the Reporters Committee decision is an appropriate, a sensible balancing of the interests at stake. And in the notes I made to myself about what I might say here, I wrote, are agencies going to be good at it? Well, no. And that, I think, is one of the primary problems that Lucy and Tonda have talked about, is that agencies, individual bureaucrats in agencies, don't have a good understanding of what balance they're trying to strike. And given the leeway to make a decision under the Reporters Committee case, they make a decision that favors themselves, that is, withholding information. So the story is really not so much the legal case as it is the set of bureaucratic incentives to protect information, because that protects themselves. It maintains power. It lowers the risk that reporters will get some insight into misdeeds or wrongdoing within their own agencies. And so I do think that the important story may be the bureaucratic behavior. But I'll defend the FOIA law or the Reporters Committee case because FOIA is a tool for inquiring into government. It's a tool for inquiring into right or wrong in federal agencies. It's not meant to be a way of digesting personal information for the use of reporters, important as some of that may be to the reporting function. It's a question that's parallel to one that comes up in intellectual property contexts. Can you use this tool over here for reverse engineering something different? Can you use a government oversight tool to reverse engineer personal information, even personal information of public interest? The solution, my obligation as a think tanker at a libertarian think tank, is to put some of that those ideas out there for you. The solution here, of course, is to limit the size and scope of government, because everything we ask the government to do to help people results in records about people's health care, their finances, et cetera, et cetera. So the long-term solution, every good thing we ask the government to do results in records, and that's why people are so concerned. There are databases at the Department of Health and Human Services where, you know, everything down to the people's bowel movement records are in these databases. It's very concerning to have this much data in the hands of government. But there is balancing to be done, and I think Ari struck on something important when he talked about fields. It's for the longest time we've talked about records. Can I get an arrest record? Well, we can do a better job by being more granular about what information can be revealed. And maybe it's appropriate to get the bulk of an arrest record, but some of the fields in the arrest record aren't available, like financial services information, like perhaps even the names of arrestees, because an arrest obviously is not proof of much of anything, except for maybe the factual circumstances of someone having been arrested, not that they did something wrong. So breaking down and doing a precise job of determining what information should be available to reporters, not on a per record basis, but on a per field basis, is probably the way to go forward in the future. maintaining practical obscurity while making information that should be available to the press and public available.
Okay. Tonda?
The role of the press in oversight of the public's right to know, I guess, is one I think that is ill understood in the circles that try to carve out how this balancing act will take place, I think. And I want to use one of my least favorite privacy laws as an example, and that is the HIPAA laws. Talk about a reverse engineered process. HIPAA was created with one sentence on the floor of the House when Congress decided it was going to try to set standards that let workers take their health insurance from job to job, and punted the whole privacy debate to an agency at HHS. And we wound up with what HIPAA now is, which is an amalgamation of lots of civil and criminal statutes and lots of regulatory code. And you can make yourself sleepless trying to read through all of it sometimes. If you have a debate with someone who fervently believes in medical record privacy, and no one here would disbelieve in that, I don't think. Where's the role of the press in getting access to information that would be covered by a HIPAA record? And just as an example, back in the days when I was a newspaper reporter, if someone was in a car accident on the highway, you follow the ambulance to the hospital and you ask the third floor head nurse, is he alive? Is he dead? What happened? Well, yeah, he's here. He's got a broken bone and a minor head injury, and he's in satisfactory condition. We'll probably release him tomorrow. And you got the information and the name, because there wasn't a concern about it at that time. Well, that's all, of course, not available any longer, because the nurses are all under criminal sanction if they give you that information. So the reporters are saying, well, look, we can't find out anymore who was in the car accident. Well, you go to the police department and get it if there was a car accident. You get the police record. Well, wasn't filed. We can't get it. The police didn't file it. Okay, well, then you don't need to know it. You do not need to know this. If you needed to know it, the police would have told it to you. We don't want the hospitals giving this information. And the press organizations are saying, well, the result of this is reporters are going to stop covering stories about car accidents. Well, why would they do that? Because there's still an accident. They can still write that there's an accident. We'll just delete the field that has the name in it, which is kind of where this deletion theory comes up. Well, you know what? That's not going to happen, folks. There's no story there. There's no name. And I think that's, in the course of the HIPAA development, it was a perfect example of where there was really no public voice. There was a privacy voice, and it was very, very strong. And it was within the agency. The press organizations largely, I think, missed that whole debate until it was pretty much all over with. What we've lost in that context, and I think it's an easier one to see and touch people with probably than the medical brothers' rap sheets, is a general sense that the community has an idea where people are. My neighbor went to the hospital. I heard the hospital admissions report on the radio station. I saw the birth records run in my local community newspaper. The Amtrak train went off the rails in Jacksonville, Florida, and I read that my second cousin was in the accident. I wouldn't have known otherwise. All of that stuff has been now obscured by HIPAA. It's practically obscured because in the end, yes, there will be a police report. Yes, there will be an Amtrak investigation. Yes, there will be maybe an ambulance log if you can get to it. But no one will ever really know it unless they personally make a mission to go find it. The press won't write about it because there's no name. The press won't have access to it because it's not timely and they can't get it on a practical basis. And so as a result, you've just pulled a whole chunk of human activity off the public record in a sense. And what you've done is remove a set of eyes and ears of the public from the whole medical establishment. It's not being looked at. It's not being paid the attention to, because you've taken the human story out. You've redacted the human being, if you will. And one of the ironies of it is, and this is one of the obscurity pieces of the regulations, it's what it's done is create a closed circle accountability within the medical community. and the healthcare establishment. If something goes wrong, a whistleblower can't go talk to the press without risking HIPAA criminal sanctions. If you're in an emergency room and the nurse sees the patient attack the doctor, the nurse can violate the patient's privacy to the extent of running out to the corner and grabbing a police car going by and reporting that the crime happened. But if you're in the emergency room and the doctor attacks the patient, under the privacy regulations, the nurse can't go tell anyone, except maybe to go to the hospital board, to the medical society, ultimately to the police, in this kind of all within the government closed circle accountability, and there may not be any public oversight into it at all, through the press or directly as a public citizen. There is no public voice in setting the balance when regulations like this are created, and there is no public represented in the creation of some of these databases and questions that come up. The press tries, but of course we've got this selling headlines problem dragging around with us every place we go, and I think that disables to some degree the value of our voice. I don't know how we put pinholes into some of these closed loops that we're creating to protect privacy, other than more layers of more government people to oversee them, more IGs, more auditors, more people that are inside a loop but can't really tell anyone what happened, except in sterile, non-named facts.
I understand that point of view, but I think that in general the public is also concerned about the other side as well, right? We're moving into a world where we're going to have health records that are going to be tied to individuals from birth until death, right? Today, in the example that you gave, where you went up to the third floor and you talked to someone and you got their name, all that person knew was that person was admitted for a car accident. In the future, when we move into a health IT world where we're all going to have all of our information tied, that individual is going to have complete access to the entire medical history of that individual, and that's where the concern has come in. And from the computerization side of health records. Now, I don't think HIPAA's the solution. And obviously it's not, because in the stimulus package that just passed, we have a whole new set of health IT privacy rules to put in place, because HIPAA didn't cover Google or Microsoft as people that were gathering health records, and they are doing that today, and they want to do that into the future. So we have a whole new set of health laws that are going to cover more people. The question is, what is your new solution? The answer of, well, we should be able to go up and talk to that guy on the third floor and him tell us the name, is not in the future. You can cross that out. That's just not acceptable when they have the whole answer, the way that it was, where they have the whole list of a person's history. So what are the limitations on that person and that discussion that takes place versus the idea of the kind of rock controls that you see from HIPAA today, and I never hear that from the openness advocates, and I think that's where the breakdown happens. Not so much in your lack of ability to influence. I do think you guys have a lot of influence. The problem is you don't have the message as to where the balance should be. So the privacy people end up winning out in the end, because they actually say, well, here's where we're willing to compromise and move in, and you have some people that are willing to do that in the privacy space. You have a lot of people to the far extreme that are not willing to do that and say that everything that happens is bad, but you do have some people in the middle that are willing to do that. I hear that less from the openness.
Before you respond, and you should, let me make a comment or two. There's no defending the HIPAA law, which is a piece of junk, and Congress abdicated responsibility when it wrote it. But I was thinking carefully about what you said, Tonda, and I didn't find myself mourning the loss of the stories about individual car accidents. I think there should be reporting on lots of things of public interest, but it isn't a given to me that somebody suffering an accident of some kind should show up in the papers. If they want to communicate that to others, they can communicate that to people in their local community. People have plenty of capacity to do so by email and Twitter and every other way. It's not one of the heroic roles of the press to report on car accidents and things like that. I agree there's a marginal argument that, that in the aggregate, stories about lots of accidents may bubble up some problem with the healthcare system, some problem with traffic safety, but those can also be bubbled up other ways. And so I wasn't impressed. I hate to come down, you know, against reporting in a slight degree, but I didn't feel a loss from hearing that we weren't going to know the names of car accident victims.
Well, and you're articulating, I think, two roles that are pressed upon us often for the press. One is people don't really need to know this information. And the other is the press can still do its public oversight role, but they need to do it as a textbook. They need to do it with facts and figures and dry information that doesn't have human beings attached to it. And I would say, okay, but it won't. And it's not going to, and no one would read it if we did, except for all of us sort of narrow policy wonks that care about reading newspapers that write like textbooks. I mean, come on, folks. What we're losing here is that sense of interconnectedness in the community. Yeah, maybe it's just gossip that your next-door neighbor was in a car accident. But it is one of those things that helps to draw together the human community. It is something that has some public interaction involved in it, because usually it involves the use of some public resource. An ambulance, the highway got shut down. I couldn't get to church on time because somebody was drunk driving and ran their car off the road, and now the highway's barricaded, and I would like to know why I couldn't.
I would use a different one on your side, which is right now we're talking about swine flu all the time, right? People who have a disease, when there's a mass outbreak like that, how do you know the government is, and the health officials are treating that information well? You need oversight like the press. So I agree that there is a legitimate press concern over some medical information. However, I just need to hear the other side of where you think that line gets drawn.
But the press role isn't to try to be the governing body of the institutions. The press role is to push a lot of information out there into the public in the context of human stories. That's what the press does. It's not the press's job to come compile the facts and figures. That really is the legitimate government oversight role of some public interest group or an auditor or an IG or someone. It's the press's job to tell the human stories. And as we're stripping, in the interest of privacy, stripping those human beings out there, we are losing the biggest tool the press has to motivate people in the public to come do that public oversight of the institutions. Here's where, I know Dan didn't mean this to be a HIPAA conference, and I just happened to pick that because it happens to be one of my own.
It's a good example because it's right at the cross section.
Well, and I think it's also a good example because when you think about why people care about keeping their medical records private, what do you really care about? Who can hurt you with your medical records information? It's your insurance company that can use it to raise your rates. It's your employer who can use it to produce employment discrimination. Maybe it's a law enforcement officer that can figure out that you're abusing narcotics. I mean, you can think about all the specific entities that have got power to use against you, and every single one of them has access to those records because they have gotten into the process as this balancing act gets struck.
That's not true.
Or it's always going to happen.
School officials don't have it over kids that get pregnant, right?
Well, there are some exceptions that don't, but I will affirm to you that every one of the industries that has an organized lobby has gotten what they need to know.
Well, that's a different subject.
And that's going to happen in the legislature because it's a lobbying process. So you look at the folks that are drawn within the circle that can get access to the records. Most of the entities that you're worried about hurting you are inside the circle. They have access to the information. What's left out are the general public that doesn't have a voice in this, the press that wants to put the car accident story in the newspaper that you don't really think you should have to read, else that's interested in this sort of public fabric.
I have to say that you're drawing the circle just exactly where you think it should be rather than where people themselves think it should be. There are people who don't want information exposed about them who think reporters are inside that circle.
Well,
there isn't an arbitrary line that you can draw that says these folks can hurt you and these folks can't, because reporters can hurt you by writing about, I'm not particularly sensitive about my personal health information, but there are plenty of people who just the mere fact of undergoing a medical procedure is something they want to keep private. And so you're inside the circle to them, you're not inside the circle to me or to you, but people's privacy preferences are not.
I would say there are a lot of people that are outside the circle too. Employers can, who obviously can lobby, they're outside the circle. There are a lot of examples you can come up with of people that are not. That can't get access to information now because of HIPAA. Again, not saying HIPAA is a perfect law. I do not think it is perfect at any extent. I mean, how many people go through and read the actual form and then sign it at the doctor's office? No one does. So clearly it's not working. But in terms of people that shouldn't have access to that information now not have access? There are a lot of cases where that is true.
Well, let's move this away from the issue, the red-hot button issue of medical privacy, and go back to something that was more contemplated by the original Reporters Committee case, and having to do with practical obscurity. And I think back to a hearing I sent one of my reporters/lawyers to in Maryland about 5 years ago. And Maryland's judiciary was having conversations. They had a task force about compilations of criminal rap sheet or criminal conviction data. And I had a conflict, so I sent one of my young pit bull lawyers, and she was poised to speak up at this public hearing. And granted, this wasn't police data, this was court data. But the argument was that this was practically obscure, and if we put it in a place where it's going to be accessible for the public, all sorts of bad things are going to happen. And, you know, my young lawyer didn't have to stand up and say a danged thing on behalf of the media, because the employers were there, the landlords were there, and the daycare center operators were there. And they wanted this information so that they could see whether or not, when they're hiring daycare center workers, they can do a background check on them. The employers wanted to know whether or not somebody had a criminal rap sheet. For heaven's sake, the landlords want to know it to see whether or not these people are deadbeats that have had, you know, been sued or have criminal records for theft, all of these things. There is a heck of a lot more interest out there in data of this sort than just the media. And once you make it, you know, get the word out to these other lobbies, they're just even more aggressive out there about bringing.
That's true. I was on that task force actually, and I think it came to a good place of the balance. Now, this is where I say, you know, you guys actually do have a voice. I mean, the person who wrote that report was a lawyer for the Washington Post.
Carol Millamed.
Yeah. So there was a it's not like the journalists weren't at the table and these other voices were the ones who wrote it. I mean, someone representing journalists wrote that. But I also think that there was it's a perfect example of what I was trying to talk about, which is, can we get to the right balancing test? I think that Maryland document, and it sounds like you agree, is a good document in terms of getting to the right test about we can use these levers that I was talking about before should be in place, and what type of people should have access to them and how it should work. I hold it up all the time as an example to other jurisdictions that are looking into the example. The question is, can we sit down at the table and come up at that kind of level, bring all the interests around the table, including the privacy interests, including journalists, including the others that want access, and try and come up to the right balancing test with an understanding of the benefits from both sides. And I think that we can do that if you're willing to sit down. Now, the harder part is, do we have to do this for every database that's out there? And the answer right now is yes, and that's what makes it really hard.
Isn't that balancing test inevitably, when you sit down and work that out, going to become a need-to-know question?
I don't think so in every case. I mean, I give the example of the bankruptcy records. I did that one on purpose because I think that I'd prefer to have instances where the information is just not collected, or when it is collected, it's used for the purpose that the government intended to use it for, and then no one gets access to it, that one field.
Well, Ari,
Jim was talking about, but if in certain cases you're not going to be able to do that, so then there's a question of need to know, and how do we get to that?
Are we ever going to be able to go to government and have them make a realistic assessment of, hey, why are we collecting this to begin with?
Some jurisdictions have done that it's very difficult to do. I agree with you. It's very difficult to do.
Okay. So both governments and most technical systems default to collecting and keeping information. So it's pushing back, not just against government, but against most database designs.
That's right. That's really what the Privacy Act was trying to get to.
Correct. Originally. Number one point of the Privacy Act.
There's that famous section in the Privacy Act that absolutely forbids the use of Social Security numbers as identification numbers. And who's ever seen that enforced? I think we've got a huge struggle on this. But to me, I think everybody's got a balancing test. And their balancing test is my privacy is important to me, and I have a right to know about you.
But that's a good example, because if agencies didn't use the Social Security number as the identifier, they came up with their own identifier, then there's less of a problem of making it public. We had this come up in the Fed database, the contracts database that was made available, where the Department of Agriculture was embedding people's Social Security numbers in their contractor ID. So then when it was all made public, which, you know, I know Jim was all in favor of making this public as much as we were, as much as the press was, right? Let's make the contractor data available. But then Social Security numbers are embedded in them, and because they violated the Privacy Act, it became a privacy issue. So can we address that concern up front, get the agencies to follow the law, so that we don't bring up privacy issues as we're making information that was never available before now widely available?
You know, we have probably 10 minutes or so before Dan is going to feed us lunch. If anyone has any questions, please come up to the microphones, and we'll be happy to. If you don't come up, I'm going to start doing the Socratic thing and call on you.
I've got one brief comment. My name is Pat Clausen. I'm a private investigator and an investigative reporter. Mr. Harper. I'm going to explain to you exactly why traffic report records need to be open and why they're consequential. About, 30 years ago, I ran across an incident out in the Midwest where a young man had been killed in a traffic accident. Young teenager, good athlete, good student. Problem was is that the night of the accident, the police threatened his family with violence if they spoke out about the accident. And the records were sealed. There was nothing showing up on the police blotter about the accident. All right? There was a report of an ambulance call, but that was it. And reporters didn't know anything about it. Just a routine thing on the blotter about an ambulance call. Nothing about an accident. A few months later, the family filed a wrongful death action in the court to seek recompense for the loss of their son. Within 15 minutes of filing that lawsuit, the chief judge in that circuit issued a gag order and a sealing order on his own motion on the lawsuit. It was taken completely off the public record. Ultimately, what we found out occurred was the kid had been hit and killed by a judge who was grossly intoxicated, who was never arrested despite his intoxicated status, who the police actually gave a ride home to. Nothing about this ever appeared in the newspaper, partly because the judge was out with a mistress that night. The mistress was the city editor of the newspaper in that community. All right? It's very important accident reports be made available to the public because it's a check against corruption. The same thing with Social Security numbers, which people have a hard time about, okay? If the Pentagon were to suddenly close off defense contract numbers or defense contract identifying information to the public, a lot of you would be screaming. A Social Security number is simply a government contract number. What in the hell should be top secret about a Social Security number? Now, we may have some issues about the usage of a Social Security number, but the number itself is a relatively innocuous fact. The problem is that what arises with Social Security numbers is the problem is that the banking community, because it is too cheap to put into place decent security, the banking community continues to use these as authenticators, not identity verifiers. That's what the root of the problem is with Social Security numbers. Recently in Detroit, I had to locate a defendant in a civil matter. His name was Lewis Smith. You want to have any idea how many Lewis Smiths there are in the city of Detroit? There's over 242, according to Accurate and according to Lexis. Ultimately, it was through SSN information over a prolonged period of time that we were able to finally identify the defendant and get that defendant served with process. Having these numbers available are very important to the public. At Christmas time, a little over a year ago, I was able to reunite a father with a son that he had never met. The son who had been told for almost 18 years that his father was dead. I was able to reunite them on Christmas Eve as the man was on his death's bed, in no small measure because of a Social Security number. So as we go pell-mell into sealing off these records in the name of privacy, you've got to realize that this has a direct negative effect on people and a direct negative effect on the public interest every time we seal one of these records. I agree information needs to be used responsibly. Sealing off records is not the solution.
I appreciate your comments. Let me say, as to Lewis Smith, you had it easy. At least it wasn't John Smith or Bob Smith, right? That's a wildly humorous joke, people. Can I get a little help? Thanks. And I appreciate it. I don't think I made the case. I'm pretty confident I didn't make the case for closing all traffic records. In fact, we talked about the fields. You could require that all traffic reports be disclosed without disclosing the victims in traffic accident cases. But moreover, the example you used was a case where government officials were abusing the existing rules.
That happens every day in this country.
And so having rules in place for open records doesn't solve the problem that you just cited. That's actually not part of the balancing we're talking about here. We're all opposed to abuse of the rules. We're trying to figure out what the rules are supposed to be for when the rules are not abused. These are important considerations, and you're right that we're talking about tensions between real human interests. And in some cases, there are discrete examples of very striking losses to people because of these things. But those are balanced against broad losses of privacy interests of people. And you're also right on the Social Security number. We have this awful setup where a number that's well-known and widely used is also supposed to be kept generally secret. And that's the identity system we have in the country is a mess. Retooling is a huge hassle. But in the meantime,
read Jim's book. He's not going to tell you to read his book, but read his book. He does say exactly what you said in his book.
In the meantime, we've got to strike these balances between disclosure and non-disclosure of SSN. So important question. Thanks,
so Patrick's stories are that medicinal herb in the forest. And I don't think you get to them by taking all the records and taking the names out of them. And the names are what make that human connection happen, and the things that drive the interest and cause investigators like Patrick to be able to do the work he does.
In that story, these people put their names in the public record by filing a lawsuit. So you really have abandoned that privacy interest. But again, that's the story of abuse of the rules, not a story of what the rules are.
Rick.
I'm Rick Bloom with the Sunshine and Government Initiative. I wanted to ask about privatization of the data itself, where information is moved out of government control, or the systems are designed increasingly so that the information is moved out of government control. So either private entities are the holders of the information and then government benefits from it, like an information sharing analysis center on the security related area, or say government may collect like a phone book, a registry of information, and say, look, we'll call you if we need you. And you know, if we need to trace back foodborne illness from the plate to the farm, you know, we now have a registry, or they're trying to collect a registry of all farms. And we'll call you if there's an outbreak, and we think so that we can figure out where this thing occurred. Is privatization of information control growing? Do you agree with my assertion that it's a growing phenomenon? And then is it more of a solution to this balance conundrum or more of a problem?
Well, I think
in 2 minutes,
accumulations of data are growing in both the private and the government sector. The interesting problems to me, and I'm sure Ari has thoughts on this as well, is the crossover between the two, where the government is going to the private sector and saying, we need all the data on this person, and stuff that may not have been collected in ways that the government appropriately should collect information. So it's essentially an end run around the Privacy Act for government, especially if government collects information, shifts it over to the private sector, and lets it be worked with over there. and then calls on the private sector later. Well, the protections, meager as they are, of the Privacy Act don't apply against private data collectors. And so that is privatization in a sense, but it's when the government uses information that hasn't been subject to the sort of rules. You got a lot of fairness problems, essentially due process problems, when you know information's been collected for the purposes of employment background checks, are then used as investigatory material. Well, those are different. You know, you have different levels of accuracy for those different contexts. So there are a lot of problems with that crossover between the two.
I'd say, there's a whole range of these different types of relationships between private sector and public sector, and different standards that apply. And I feel kind of weird talking about this since Dan Metcalf is sort of more of an expert on these issues than I am. But the Privacy Act applies for a lot of these in a lot of these cases where information is collected by the government and they contract out someone to do it. It is covered by the Privacy Act and is covered by FOIA as well, my understanding, right? Is that right? Correct, Dan? If it's a might depend on some of the circumstances, but. There's an issue in terms of broadness. So I think that the case that Jim raised, I think we want it to be covered under the existing law today. In practice, we have to see how that works. The harder question is these cases where you have the government contracting out to a private sector database where they don't bring the information into the government. They just read it off the screen, and then so they're having, where in the past, when the Privacy Act was written, the idea was you would bring this information into be a system of records, and then it would be incorporated in, and you would create a database out of it because you'd be pulling all this data in, and then it would be covered by the Privacy Act. If they're just reading it off the screen one by one, it is not covered under the law today. There's no privacy rules on that information at all. There's no FOIA-ability of that information. Both the privacy advocates and the open government advocates lose in that case, and the government can be doing. There clearly could be some oversight concerns about what government is doing with that data.
Another dimension of that outsourcing concept is federal programs that require states to collect a great deal of data. The Real ID Act is a law I've worked on quite a bit, and it essentially requires states to develop databases of information about their drivers, share those databases, at least make them interoperable in ways. And because they're state-controlled databases, those certainly subject to federal, they're created for federal purposes. Because they're state-controlled, they're not subject to the Federal Privacy Act, they're not FOIA-able, and so that's another way that the government's done an end run around the meager protections of the Privacy Act.
I'd like to thank our panelists. And Dan, do you have any instructions?
Yes, sir.
I'll say that Ari mentioned the swine flu thing. Thank you all for your bravery in stepping out into a public place.
So it's not too practically obscure. The lunch is on the other side of this building on the same floor. And our luncheon speaker is Mary Ellen Callahan, who's the new privacy officer at DHS. And lunch, I think they're ready for us in about 15 seconds. So if anyone can make it there in 15 seconds, you'll be early. Otherwise, everyone will be right on time.
Okay.
And again, thank you to this panel for your very active discussion.